Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. We are picking up steam here, and it is turning into something super fun and valuable for me, and I'm so glad that you guys are letting me know the same thing about you, whether it's through my Instagram or sending me emails. And so I appreciate you all, and I'm glad you guys are finding value here. Wedding photography is such a multifaceted pursuit. You have the creative side, which probably is what brought you into photography in the first place, and then you have the attempt at refining your own skills and pushing yourself to excellence in that world. Which is a whole job in itself. And then you have the other task of fostering a real life business. And that is if you want to be successful in the long run. And so for many people, including myself, this is where things start getting a little scary. You have contracts and fancy language, bank accounts, lawyers, all that good stuff, accounting. And many of us have never actually had the formal education in that area. We have to learn it all on our own, which is why this week's episode is so special to me. We have the amazing opportunity to hear from Keely McKay, a wedding photographer based out of Bozeman, Montana, who is also a full-time business attorney. Something I really loved about Keely was her ability to make the law talk less scary, and I felt that afterwards I had a little more motivation in this world to start asking scary questions and finding real answers. One note to make about Keely is she's based out of Montana and I'm from California, and so this interview is more of a way to get started thinking about law and photography than anything else. And so without further ado, here we go, Keely McKay.
I did, yeah. Just got home, took the dog out for a quick walk, and now I'm here.
Dude, man, well, I appreciate you taking time out of, you know, like your crazy life. I'm sure it's busy, right, with doing both things to do this.
It is, but I'm really glad to be here. This is something I love talking about, and I love seeing people like you actually care about sort of the fundamentals and the groundwork, because that's kind of the unsexy side of what we do. And I think it gets passed over until there's a problem. So
cool.
I love that you're bringing some attention to building those sort of foundation or building blocks.
Yeah, no, it's something to me that's terrifying. And, sure. And that's because I don't know anything about it. Right. Or at least like, I think maybe there's the mist involved in it. So, I'm stoked to start or to just even have a few minutes with you about this. So
I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So earlier, so just to give you like background as to what I'm doing. So during this whole coronavirus thing, I was like always wanting to start this podcast. I'm a full-time teacher and I have like zero time yeah. So with the whole coronavirus, I'm not like commuting. So I have this extra time. So I've reaching out to these awesome people just like, hey, you know what? I'll shoot for the stars. And if people say yes, then I'll just do it. And, it's been super fun. I got like Jose Villa on earlier today to talk about, it was incredible. So really cool people who are like, up for doing this. And so pretty much it's just like a conversation, super chill, like just talking mostly the stuff that I really like about, can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, I can.
Okay. The stuff that I like to listen to in podcasts is more of just like how people got started, just really like their story and just like hear from other photographers, because there's always like that one nugget in an hour of listening that you're like, oh, that was awesome, you know. So and I feel like just regular conversations, that's pretty easy to have that. So thanks for doing this. As we're going through, I have like questions written down, so if I'm like looking down, I'm like referencing these questions in case I'm like setting up for the next one or whatever, and I'll be like taking notes too to help me. So I've been putting these on YouTube and a podcast. I'm still waiting on Apple to submit it or to accept it. Is that okay with you? I know Jose didn't want to go on YouTube, so that's...
It's fine with me. I don't have any problem with it.
All right, cool. So you want to jump into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, cool. So how about you just tell us about how you got into like photography, and... Because you're a full-time lawyer also. So maybe give us like your background story, like how you got into law. Those are two pretty like almost not opposites, but I mean, they're different worlds for sure.
Yeah. My story is really anticlimactic. I decided when I was 10 that I was going to be the president, and I thought you had to be a lawyer first to be president. So when I was 10, I decided I was going to be a lawyer because that's what I thought you had to do to... to be the president, and I really never looked back. I never thought twice about it. But my mom was a photographer, and so I grew up with a 35 millimeter in my hand. I learned to shoot with her and have just always had a camera. I love it. It was just never something I even considered doing as a profession. And then in law school, it sort of became my creative outlet. And eventually, at that point, I was really just taking pictures of, it's called three-day eventing. It's an equestrian sport. So I also ride horses. And so I would go to these events and just bring my camera and take pictures of competitors. And I love that. And eventually people started asking if I could take family pictures. And
nice.
Then it just kind of snowballed. And I fell into a photography career that I never expected to have. And I suspect that's true for a lot of people. Cameras are easy to get your hands on, and eventually you get good and people want to pay you for it. And you're running a business before you ever meant to run a business.
Yeah.
So, two completely opposite tracks. But I love both, and by doing both, I get to not have to be a lawyer 80 hours a week, not tied to my desk, but I still get to make the kind of money I need and want to make.
Yeah, totally. Are you still planning on shooting for presidency or?
No.
Oh, no? Okay.
Local politics, probably.
But oh, really? Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah, but I no longer want to be the figurehead.
No, okay. That's interesting. Wow. So like politics, that's to me, like, not to go like way off track, but that's like, to me, like, as I'm like, I don't know, getting older, like I'm a teacher, like I just told you, full time. And so like, I'm like thinking, oh man, I'm starting to see problems in the world. I'm like, I need to fix some of this stuff. So anyways, it's just like, it's just interesting how it's something that seems so scary. And then I don't know, it seems like so attainable and actually like practical and helpful, I guess. So anyways, so you got into law school because you wanted to like pursue something larger, but then in law school, did you have to like decide on like a branch of law that you wanted to study? How does that work?
No. So fortunately law school is really just kind of, teaching you the fundamentals of research and writing, truly analysis. Your core classes are kind of a semester or a year of all of the basic areas of law, like criminal law, constitutional law, contracts, real estate, all of that. And so you get kind of a crash course in all of it. And I suppose in bigger areas and bigger schools, you probably, or a lot of people probably do kind of pick a specialty. In Montana, it is really hard to make a living in a niche or a specialty practice, just because we're a large state, we have a very small population, and so not enough to truly support a real niche practice. So in Montana, most people don't specialize. We do have some who do, but in law school, you're kind of getting to know the ropes as far as your research, analysis, and writing go.
Oh, okay. Right on. And so like, do you do the kind of law where it's like you're in a courtroom type stuff, or is there?
Yes. I have tried to really focus my practice on estate planning, business succession planning, and small business advisory. And so I do get to work with, and I'm going to pause for a second.
Yeah.
If you hear noises, it's my bulldog.
Cool. No problem. If you hear noises on mine, it's my child running around. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, I've tried to focus on transactional work, and I get to work with a ton of local wedding planners, photographers, florists, all of that. And I love it. But the first, I've been practicing for going on 6 years now. And the first 5 years, it was truly litigation focused. And that was mostly in the land access litigation arena. So I represent both public access interest groups and private landowners, depending on the case. Because Montana has so much public land, but not that you want a history lesson or a crash course in property law, but here it's all checkerboarded. So we've got public land bordered by private land, and there's no guaranteed access to that public land. So we have a ton of land access disputes here. And so that was kind of the first 5 years of my practice as I was building my transactional practice. So yes, on the litigation side, I do spend a lot of time in the courtroom. I don't like litigation, but I think it has truly benefited my transactional practice because I have a better understanding now of what judges actually look for. And it's not theoretical. And I can help my clients better understand their contracts and what it looks like if they're actually trying to enforce a contract, what the judge is going to look for, how to stay out of the courtroom, truly. And I think that's the most beneficial part of the litigation side is getting a better grip on mediation and negotiated resolution so that people never have to make it to the courtroom.
So thinking about that then and switching over real quickly to wedding photography, what are some of like the major problems you see as far as like wedding photographers? Do you ever deal a lot with like wedding industry professionals and law and lawsuits and things like that? And what are some of like the popular topics that are argued over?
Right now, and this is going to probably be very obvious, but right now it's all about deposits or retainers or whatever you want to call them, and whether or not they are truly non-refundable as people have to kind of pivot and change their plans because of pandemic, government shutdowns, or stay-at-home orders, things like that. So in addition to the land access litigation, I have a ton of contract disputes that started as lawsuits, but we've been able to resolve them through negotiation. So those never have to make it to the courtroom, except in some very, very nuanced situations where the parties just can't agree on a solution. But yeah, a ton of work with like business disputes, transactional disputes in the wedding industry, and as business owners in general, I represent a handful of construction companies. And while the work that they do is different, sort of the core disputes are largely the same, and the resolution is largely the same. So,
so what do you mean by that? For the person listening on their commute who's like thinking about getting into photography, and they're like, lawsuits, this sounds crazy. I don't know about this. What do you mean? Like, they're all kind of the same as far as.
That's obviously a huge overgeneralization, but I think the thing that I see most is the common thread is a lack of communication. And it starts at the very beginning. Part of that is when you pull a contract off the internet or, just buy a form, someone who doesn't have a legal background, they tend to just trust that what they have in the contract is what it's supposed to be, and it should be clear to the reader. And they maybe don't take the time to understand it themselves, or maybe they try to, and they feel like they have a good understanding, but their understanding is different than the client's. And so, at the very beginning, if the parties are going into it with a different understanding of what happens, we're setting ourselves up for problems in the long run. And hopefully it'll never come to pass, because hopefully your wedding gets to go on as planned. Photographer shows up and everyone's happy. There's never a problem. But I think everything that's come across my desk as a result of COVID-19 has been because the parties had a fundamentally different understanding of their remedies in the event something beyond either party's control happened. And I'm not faulting the photographer or the clients. It's something that no one could have anticipated. And even as a lawyer, I tell people, like, we do the best we can to put like the most solid contract in place. But my own photography contract, I'm updating it probably every time I send it out, just because when you read it through again, or when you have an experience that you hadn't predicted, you realize there are some things that you could improve in your contract, situations that you couldn't have predicted. But now it makes sense to address them in your contract.
Can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit? Like, what kind of stuff would you add to a contract that you wouldn't have?
So what I just added to my contract is I added a specific section to my force majeure and impossibility clause about pandemics, epidemics. Government actions was already in there, but I had never contemplated a worldwide pandemic. And so I didn't have anything in my contract that spoke specifically to pandemics. And so I have changed my force majeure clause. Montana really doesn't, while we recognize force majeure, Montana courts typically fall back on impossibility rather than force majeure. So it's basically the same thing in application, but it looks a little different here. So I have updated that provision to address pandemics and epidemics. I have also updated my canceling and rescheduling clause to specifically address like a mandatory reschedule. And for me personally, I've decided that I'll transfer. I call it a non-refundable booking fee rather than a retainer or a deposit. If there's a mandatory reschedule, postponement or something due to force majeure event, I'll allow them to transfer that booking fee to the one rescheduled date. But I also capped it at within the following calendar year. If they move it out further, I can't just let it go out forever and ever. So for me, it was mostly an exercise in thinking through all of the questions that I would be asked by couples who have to reschedule, and making sure that my contract now addresses each of those scenarios, and differentiating between a truly mandatory postponement and one that is simply a matter of choice. So those were the two big changes that I made to my contract. And I probably should back up real quick and just put the caveat out there that I'm not allowed to give legal advice without an attorney-client relationship in place. I'm licensed in Montana and Arizona and can only speak to the laws applicable to those states. So none of this is intended to be advice. It's just general information about what I've done.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. So let's back up even farther too, because there's a photographer driving, listening to this, who's like, my contract says deposit. What's the difference between deposit, retainer? Or I like what you read it as non-refundable. Non-refundable
booking fee.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk, I think, I mean, just because of where we're at right now, about these words specifically. And so how important is the actual word itself?
So in my experience in Montana and Arizona, the word itself is not important. What really matters is how you explain its purpose in the contract. What does it do? What entitles you to keep it in the event of the client's breach or even your breach? I personally would never keep a deposit if I'm the one who breached the agreement. But so my non-refundable booking fee clause is a full paragraph explaining exactly what it goes towards and why it is earned at certain intervals. And then I have a separate liquidated damages clause. And I think that is kind of a source of confusion for a lot of people.
What is that liquidated damages?
Is a contract principle that just says, essentially, the parties wish to agree on the measure of damages in the event of one party's breach. So rather than going to through the process of trying to prove damages at trial, the parties have just said in the contract, in my case, if clients breach, I am entitled to X amount, which is less than the full value of the contract, but more than my booking fee. And that is what we have decided is reasonable compensation for my investment and their late termination of the contract. So it's what pays me for having had to give up that date, not being able to rebook it. And there's some confusion. I think people I see all the time in Facebook groups that they get to keep the entire value of the contract. that they, or they can even force the client to pay the balance if the client cancels within a certain amount of time. And at least in Montana, that's really hard to enforce, just because the judge is going to look at you and say, but you didn't have to show up that day. You didn't have to shoot for 12 hours. You didn't have to edit on the back end. You didn't have film processing costs. So why are you entitled to all of these things that you're not actually out? So I have a separate liquidated damages clause that just says, in the event client terminates, I get to keep this dollar amount. And we agree that that's the extent of damages, that I'm entitled to. So, that's a liquidated damages clause. That being said, they are very, very tricky. They are generally disfavored. Montana specifically prohibits them unless they're worded exactly correctly. So that's something that I think there is some value in having a local attorney look over, because each state treats them differently and requires certain wording for it to be enforceable.
Interesting. Yeah. So for the person who's getting in photography, should they go to, like, what are your thoughts about like HoneyBook or online, I don't know, contract services and stuff like that?
So I love HoneyBook. I use it myself. I have looked through their contracts, and I have revised their contracts for other vendors who use HoneyBook and come to me with a HoneyBook template. It's a good foundation. That being said, I think experience plays a huge role in what we need to add to our contracts. And so when I take a HoneyBook contract, it's a good foundation. It's got a lot of things that a lot of other template providers don't have. It certainly has more than other non-creative industry contract templates that I've seen. They have to be tweaked, not just to align with your state's laws, but the specific industry. I just finished one for a florist, and there was a lot that was unique to a florist's job that wasn't contemplated in the template. So I think they're a great start, and they're better than nothing, absolutely. And they'll take care of you in most cases. I always tell clients, we don't plan for the 99% of time that things go right. We plan for the 1% of the time that they go wrong. And so instead of a 4-page contract, I have a 12-page contract that just tries to make sure my clients know exactly what to expect, what they're responsible for, and what they can expect of me. Yes, I think for someone who's just starting out, the challenge is always budget. You don't have a legal budget when you're just starting out. So if you invest in something like HoneyBook, certainly it's a good investment. But I would heartily recommend having a local attorney look it over and add some state-specific provisions, and even more than that, just walk the new photographer through it. Explain to them what each provision means, what it does, how it protects them, how it protects the client, so that the photographer can truly explain to their client, or when their client comes to them with a question about the contract, they can say confidently, this is what this provision means, and this is what I would do in this situation.
So should the photographer who's new to it and wants to have a solid contract, should they maybe take their HoneyBook contract template to any lawyer look it over, or who should they go to? And then about how much money I'm sure California versus Arizona, they're all different.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Montana, right? In Montana, what's like the average that someone would expect to spend to have a lawyer look it over, explain it to them, and then, tighten it up?
So for me, my hourly rate is $220 an hour. With the HoneyBook template, because I'm so familiar with it, it takes me about an hour to look it over if they haven't made a bunch of revisions to it themselves, and add what I need to add. So that's, a 200 $250 investment there. That being said, it's usually more efficient for me to draft a contract from scratch because I know exactly what I want in there and the order I want it in. I know what the judges are going to look for. And so it's easier for me to pull up my base contract and just plug in like vendor specific provisions. So in Montana, I think anywhere from, you know, $200 to $500 for a contract is probably pretty standard.
Which is great because it can save you way more than that in the future.
Yeah. And any lawyer can do it. It doesn't take a special certification or anything like that, but my advice is always to look for someone, with a transactional practice who's well versed in contract law. And if you can find someone with a creative background or someone who serves creatives as a big part of their practice, they're going to be a little bit more, they're going to be ahead of the game in terms of knowing what to expect in a wedding industry contract, or they'll be better able to anticipate the types of problems that would arise in that specific area of contract law.
Cool. Yeah. So we're already talking about contract, and I'm assuming that's part of this next question I wanted to ask you. So for the new photographer who is thinking about where to start thinking about like law and stuff, what are some areas that they should start, you know, like to prep themselves to like start exploring to, before they, I don't know, should they do these things before they take their first picture of a person, or what are your thoughts about that?
I think the lawyer in me says, yes, you should have all of those fundamentals in place. But I mean, the realist says it's not a realistic ask, because a lot of us start this truly as a hobby. And so it kind of snowballs. And certainly someone who decides they want to grab a camera to take pictures of their own kids and has no intention of doing anything more than that, they don't need to go to a lawyer, go to an accountant, set up an LLC. That being said, as soon as someone starts taking money for it or decides they want to take it up a notch and charging for their work, they should be getting their ducks in a row.
So what are those things that they should start putting in a row?
So I have a list. I'm going to pull up my phone real quick.
Cool. Okay.
Okay. So, for someone who has decided that they want to do this as a professional, even if they're just starting out, the extent they're going to be taking money, I think the first thing that you need to do is first make the decision that this is going to be not just a hobby. Once you do that, you start thinking about your presence within the state, not on the creative side, but with your Secretary of State. So in Montana, at least, we can just use our names. If I just said Keely McKay, I'm not going to choose a brand name. I'm just going to use my name. I don't have to register that with the Secretary of State. But as soon as I tack photography onto the end of it, even if I'm just a sole prop, I need to register the assumed business name with the Secretary of State. So Keely McKay Photography needs to be registered, for example. So that gets to kind of making sure the name that you want to use is available. And so first, you know, checking with your Secretary of State. Some people go as far as registering their brand name, trademarking it. I've not done that. My name's kind of unique. No one's using it. But that would entail searching the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office records and making sure that your name is available. Whatever name you want to use is available nationwide. Getting your trademark application, and if you're going that route, most people don't trademark their names. But for someone like Jose Villa, that would certainly be wise because he is sort of someone that everyone knows. And if someone else starts using his name, then we get to consumer confusion. But that's kind of a sidetrack. So on a more basic level, getting registered with the Secretary of State, if your state requires it for a sole prop, and then you think about whether or not you want to continue as a sole prop or sole proprietor, or if you want to form an entity that exists kind of on its own, separate from you. Most people are familiar with LLCs and corporations. That's a conversation that you should have with not only your lawyer, but an accountant. An accountant's going to advise you on the tax benefits as far as either one goes. The lawyer's going to advise you on the liability protection, adherence to corporate formalities. In Montana, at least, that was my dog. So in Montana, we have really strict rules with regards to corporations, and, you know, holding yearly meetings, keeping records of everything you do. And that is really cumbersome for a lot of people. And most people, especially most creatives, they don't love the paperwork, the back end of things. So I don't work with any photographers or other wedding vendors who have chosen to go the S corp route. Most everyone chooses an LLC because it's while it provides the same, again, this is just information, not advice. Check with your attorney. An LLC generally provides the liability protection of a corporation, but the favorable tax benefits of a partnership. So you're only taxed once, and that's at the individual level. For a single member LLC, we also don't have the same strict formalities. So you're not subject to the same level of scrutiny if you fail to keep your books in order. That being said, best practices are to keep your books in order. And so Secretary of State, deciding on a name, deciding which avenue you want to go, whether you want to proceed as a sole proprietor or something else. And then Gus, and then sort of thinking about how you're going to present yourself to prospective clients, websites. It was not something I thought about in the very beginning. I was like, I've got Facebook, I've got Instagram. People have been finding me. And then, I got far enough in and realized I was going to really pursue this, got started on a website, and I had a bride reach out. And the first thing she said was, my husband really recommended you, or my fiance really recommended you, but I couldn't find a website and I didn't want to work with someone who didn't have a website. And it seemed really petty, but it reminded me that is something that clients think about. It lends an air of professionalism to the business. And it gives everyone a page to find out whatever they need to find out in terms of determining whether they're going to even contact you. So thinking about the website, make sure your domain name is available. If you've chosen to use just your name, there's a good chance that it's probably available unless you have a really common name. Just checking things like that. And that's probably something that's good to do before you even register with the Secretary of State. If your domain name isn't available, it's a real bummer to have to go and re-register everything with the Secretary of State. And then kind of aligning your social media with your website, making sure that everything links back. People can always find a way back to reach you. That's not a DM. I'm terrible with DMs. So for me, having everything link back to my website, and then that with HoneyBook, I don't know if you use HoneyBook, but okay. Yeah. So use their contact page. It shoots it right to HoneyBook, and I can keep everything in one place.
For the people who are listening who don't know what HoneyBook is, could you explain quickly what you think it is?
It is a lifesaver. It is in so many ways like a virtual assistant. Excuse me for just a minute. I'm going to open it up.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
So HoneyBook is a client management system that handles everything from like that initial inquiry to sending out proposals, contracts. I do all of my gallery delivery through HoneyBook. I just pop the Pixie Set link into an email. So I have all of our clients communicate, or all of my client communication, in one place. I have all their details. There are pages that let you store all the details for their wedding day. You can make private notes, you can create workflows. So you can automate a lot of things. And
yeah, it's one of my favorite things is like, if something isn't written down, I'm going to forget about it. And so like, even having like simple things like the address, I'm like, wedding day next week, where's that address? You know, it's like, it's right there. I don't have to think about it.
So, yeah. And yeah, like it syncs with the calendar. And so as soon as I get an inquiry, the pop-up that says, we think you're available, or nope, looks like you're booked. It makes it really easy for me not to have to go scramble and look for, like my Google calendar, is just right there and I can respond and, quickly and let them know, yay or nay, I'm available. Lets you store email templates. So I don't have to recreate, some of the emails that I send several times a day.
No, HoneyBooks, it's a lifesaver. And especially thinking about like you mentioned, like having things organized and just like paper trails and just having stuff ready to go, that place, I mean, that system, kind of does it all for you. It's really great. Yeah. So is there anything else as far as like law that a person should be thinking about? You mentioned like, setting up your structure and your name and all that good stuff. What other things should someone be thinking about before they start taking on like paying clients maybe?
So as we dive into that, getting an EIN, your employer identification number, if you're going the LLC or S corp route, just means that every once in a while, someone will need an identification number. You don't have to give out your social security number. Also, when you're opening your business bank account, which that is something that is critical. And I'll explain that in just a minute, but I've never heard of a bank not requiring an EIN for an LLC account, at least, or an S corp account. Sole props, they may not, but if you have an entity that houses your business, the bank will require an EIN. So getting your EIN, and then getting your business checking and savings accounts, if you have a savings account set up. This is something that I think a lot of people, are simply unaware of, especially if they're operating as a sole prop. It's just as important to keep, work money separate from your own money. For several reasons, and some of this has become extremely apparent as clients have been demanding refunds when they've had to move their weddings. So from just the purely practical side, just keeping that money out of your own account and available to spend as you see something you want means that you have some reserve there if something goes wrong and you have to refund. I always say don't spend money you haven't earned yet. So my deposits or booking fees, they stay in the savings account. The balances, when clients pay their balances, that stays in the savings account until everything is complete and I've earned that money. My booking fees are set up on a schedule. So it's earned over time according to what I've completed on the project. So don't transfer that money until I have completed each stage. So that just helps ensure that the money is available if you do need to refund someone. And then on the liability side, there's this theory called piercing the corporate veil. And the premise is that LLCs and corporations are not truly a bubble of protection if you're abusing it. And so one thing that the court will look at is whether you're commingling your assets. So if you're using business funds to pay for private things, like your rent or, I don't know why I'm drawing a blank right now. You go to TJ Maxx and you go on a shopping spree, but you're using, clients' money, the court's going to consider that you are not adhering to the requirements of the LLC or S corp in handling your client's funds. So keeping those separate until you have earned them, or according to your pay schedule, if you're paying yourself wages or a salary, helps in the event of a dispute. If a client's trying to get it, say your personal home that you own, because you've dropped the ball, you have a better defense against getting to your personal assets if you can show that you have kept client funds separate and just paid yourself according to a schedule or as you earn those funds. So those are the two reasons I think a business account is really important, even if you are just in the very, very beginning of your photography career, just getting in the habit of keeping client funds separate from your funds until it's time to pay yourself.
So do you need to like actually schedule payments to yourself, like a paycheck, or can you just be like, you know what, this month I shot 30 weddings and I made all this money. I'm just going to take it at the end of the month. Can you do that?
Yeah. You don't need to set up a specific 2-week, you know, pay schedule or anything like that. The primary focus is going to be whether you can justify what you've taken, and not get into a commingling argument.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, go for it.
And then I think we've really touched on contracts, but that would be the next thing in my list, is just making sure that you've got solid contracts for not only for your couples, but if you're hiring a second shooter, getting your, it's usually going to be an independent contractor agreement. Sometimes a lot of people will hire them as employees, but that's an important distinction that you should make at the beginning, whether or not the person's going to be an employee or an independent contractor, and making sure your contract with that person reflects the true nature of your arrangement. And then to things like model releases, especially when you're in the portfolio building stage, just making sure that you've got a solid model release so that you can use those photos forever, however you want, and not have to risk losing what you've built. When someone says, "We broke up, I don't want those pictures online." I think getting your name, getting registered, getting your bank account set up, your EIN, getting your contracts in place are kind of the basic steps that everyone should have on their radar.
Yeah. I mean, that's all stuff that I feel like lots of people just get into photography because it's, you know, it's quick cash. Someone can pay you $200 to do something and you're like, oh, sweet. And then you just pocket it. And then it just becomes this habit of like not actually developing. And I think if I could go back, I would just like set up everything nice and clean at the beginning and then, you know, start, even though it costs so much money. I mean, HoneyBook isn't free. QuickBooks isn't free. I think even business accounts aren't free. You have to pay monthly for lots of those. So it's not like you're going to see the money right away, but you're going to set yourself up for success.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I don't know what has propagated this, but I do see a difference in how creatives and photographers in particular approach building their business versus other fields where it's more common to take out a business loan to get started. Or having had to save for years while you're waiting tables or, you know, working some other job, to have that startup capital. I see in Facebook groups all the time, I'm asking here because I can't afford a lawyer. I'm just starting out. I don't want to encourage anyone to go into debt, but the reality is that in most industries, people do take on some debt or they're working, you know, 80 or 90 hours a week, to keep a roof over their head and build a business on the side. And the one thing I forgot to touch on was insurance. Insurance may not be critical in the beginning, but it is something that I encourage all of my clients to have in place. And it is critical if you are, doing something like newborn photography where, there's maybe some additional liability. I think the one thing that I forgot to touch on that I think is important and is an additional cost.
Yeah. I mean, thinking even you brought up LLCs, on top of insurance, right? I think in LLCs, like 800 in California, at least it's like $800 a year just to have it.
Yes.
And then you have to pay taxes.
Yeah. You got the short end of the stick here. I think it's like $70 to register in Indiana, and then it's $20 a year to file your annual report. So
what in the world? Oh my gosh, that's crazy. Yeah, I guess like Google and Apple are paying the same amount of money as the new photographer here in California. That's crazy. Wow. That's
really wild.
So then you would say, if you can afford it, do an LLC. Is that kind of your opinion?
The lawyer in me says yes. But the lawyer in me also says, unless you're going to truly treat it as an LLC and do everything right, it's not going to offer the protection that people say it offers.
Cool.
It is work. And I have a case right now, litigation, and it's a piercing the corporate veil case. And it's likely going to be maybe the third case in Montana that anyone's been able to prevail on piercing the corporate veil. But in this case, there was so much commingling of assets, just using the LLC as sort of a facade for what he was doing, it's kind of highlighted for me that the LLC is not, it's not the full stop protection that people want it to be. You have to do the work on the back end, file your annual reports, keep track of what you're doing, keep your finances separate. And so in that case, the LLC may provide all the protection you need, but it doesn't just provide you cash. And so that's the other benefit of insurance. I always say there's like one scenario in which I would ever sue a client. And that's if they're slandering me and it's affecting like my future business opportunities. But if they happen to damage my equipment during a session or a wedding or something, I don't want to go after a client for that. I want to be able to submit the claim to my insurance, pay the deductible, and have my insurance just replace it. I think customer service is as fundamental a part of the liability protection as anything. And knowing your rights, but also knowing where to give will keep you out of a bad situation 9 times out of 10.
Yeah. And you mentioned, just to clarify, like the protection LLC provides, the protection it provides is pretty much like, if you get sued, they can't come after your house, right?
Yeah. So if a client sues your LLC, in theory, all that they have access to is assets owned by the LLC. So your business checking account, your equipment, if you consider it LLC assets, but if you keep your house, your car, whatever it may be, just in your individual name, that's supposed to be shielded from a judgment in the event of a lawsuit.
Cool. So I, as far as like what I wanted to ask you, that was a lot. And I think, gosh, that's already been like 40 minutes. And I know you're like super busy. Are you guys in Montana still sheltering in place, or were you ever sheltering in place? Or
we were, not to get political, but I think our governor did a good job sort of being proactive on the front end. We also have the benefit of being a large state with a small population. So we've got a lot of space naturally. So we did not get hit as hard here as so many other places. We had a stay-at-home order in place for 5 or 6 weeks, with essential businesses being able to work. And so I was in the law firm on a daily basis, but we weren't letting clients in. We were doing meetings via Zoom and phone calls and stuff like that. As of June 1st, we are in our phase two. So our 14-day travel quarantine is being lifted. I think we go up to groups of 50 for gathering. It kind of feels like we're close to business as usual, and most people are treating it that way. But it's been interesting seeing how we've reacted here and how other places have reacted, and how everyone's handling it differently and being hit differently.
So, what's kind of like the word out there as far as the future of the wedding industry and how photographers are involved with that?
You know, I don't know. I think what I've seen personally is, couples really shifting their focus on the wedding day to what's truly important to them. I personally have seen more couples who want to keep their original wedding date and just scale back. I just got off the phone with a couple who's going from 200 people to a true elopement. And then they're going to do a 1-year anniversary party that'll be their reception. And I think the photographer's role, you know, I think first and foremost, is to support our couples, not to our own detriment, but being an asset and a teammate as couples, not only go through the planning, but having to change plans in the event, not just of a pandemic, but we hear cases where someone's diagnosed with terminal cancer and they need to either up their wedding date or just change gears completely. And that's kind of an extreme example, but just I think the photographer's role truly is to be a teammate. We are the ones with the expertise. We see enough weddings that we have a level of insight that the clients probably don't. And sharing that and supporting them in their decision making, however they need to, but making sure that we are clearly communicating what that entails for us, whether there are consequences, if they're going to get dinged, if they're going to lose their deposit, and giving them some options to work with to preserve the relationship. Preserving the relationship, as long as it's a healthy and productive one, is in everyone's best interest and solves a lot of problems before they start.
So do you just photograph in Montana or are you like all over the world?
I try to stick to Montana. When I first started, I got a destination wedding in Cabo, maybe. Somewhere in Mexico. And I thought that was the coolest thing. And I was like, I'm going to be a destination wedding photographer and it's going to be great. It wasn't. It's not for me. I'm a homebody. So like, I love to travel, but I want it to be purely leisure and not a work obligation, not stressed about trying to find my way around when I'm in a rush. So I most of my work is Big Sky, Paradise Valley, Whitefish. And I have one in Portland this year, but it's a cousin and it's her wedding gift. So yeah, that's the extent of my travel.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what are some areas in your business, in your world that you're excited about in the next year or 2 years? Where were you heading, I guess?
I am just excited to start working again, honestly. Yeah. The break was nice, but I do miss the interaction with people when they're really happy. People come to photographers when they're happy and they come to lawyers when they're not happy. And I miss that balance between, most of my work is families and couples from out of state who come here for vacations, weddings. And so getting to meet people from all over and, sort of embracing whatever point they're at in their lives. But I think more specifically, I'm just, I'm excited to get better. It sounds cheesy, but education is huge to me and I'm continually growing and improving.
That's awesome. Yeah. You know, you mentioned like people going to Montana and being photographed. I don't know if it's just me, but it seems maybe this is social media and like algorithm, but it seems like Idaho, Montana, that whole area is like blowing up as like a cool place to go, right? Every kind of place. I feel like Joshua Tree had its time and then, you know, whatever, but have you seen that happen in your area?
Yes. So I live just about 45 minutes north of Big Sky, which is a huge, resort town. It's where the Yellowstone Club is, Justin Timberlake. We see a ton of people like that coming through Big Sky and Bozeman. And so that has been a huge draw for the wedding crowd. And I read not too long ago that Big Sky is the number one destination in the continental US for weddings.
What? That's crazy. I wouldn't have thought that. I would have assumed, like, I don't know, somewhere in like LA. I don't know.
That's that's crazy. The phrase figures don't lie, but liars figure comes to mind. So I think it depends on who they sample. But it is a huge destination location for weddings. And Montana, I don't know what others see the appeal as, but it truly is beautiful. It's huge and vast, and we have mountains and we have lakes and we have desert. And I think people get a kick out of the sort of guest ranch type atmosphere. We have a lot.
It feels like everyone's going up there. You have Kanye up there too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like everyone's fleeing to Montana. There's something there for sure. My wife and I were looking at it as a place to like eventually move to, but you know how things just get crazy. So, so if people have questions about, I don't know, anything relating to law or photography, is there a place that they can go to and hear from you? Or do you offer like mentorship, or what are some things or some places people can go to engage with you?
So this is a trickier and more convoluted answer than I'd like to give, but Montana has really strict rules on lawyer related services. And so I am not allowed to do like legal consultations in a photography mentorship. So I do offer mentorships, but they have to be focused on photography and the general back end, general business practices, not the actual legal advisory side of things. If they have specific legal questions, I can do that through the firm. And so our website is redmonlawfirm.com. redmonlawfirm.com. We do keep a blog. I'm not as good at updating it as frequently as I should be, but there is a blog post on COVID-19 and how that plays out with your contracts, deposits, things like that. So if people have pressing questions, that is available and timely. And then on the other side, Instagram is kind of where I spend most of my time on the photography social media side. But I do have my website too, which is just keelymckayphoto.com. I do blog on there, but I keep that to just client stuff.
Cool. So, hey, thank you so much for doing this. It was great.
It was really nice talking to you, and I hope I didn't bore you with all the nuances.
No, honestly, this is the kind of stuff that like, when I listen to a podcast, this is what I want to hear. I want to hear like education. I don't want to just hear like fluff and like, you know, stuff like that. This is the stuff that, like I said, 10 years ago when I started, I needed to hear this and nobody was talking about it. So.
Yeah. Well, kudos to you for bringing this to the forefront and making it easily available for who are just starting out.
Hey, maybe in the future we could do another one of these and we could talk about something else.
So. I'd love to.
Cool. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye.